At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. Hi, welcome to our Table Talk podcast. We are back today with two to-table pharmacists. We have Dr. Megan Morrison, who is in Texas, and we also have Dr. Katie Johnstone, which she lives in Maine. So they're at very different points in the United States, but awesome to have you guys here today. So thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much.
So Katie, do you want to introduce yourself? Megan can introduce herself to you for those that might be new to listening to the podcast. So Katie, you can go first.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Dr. Katie Johnstone, or Dr. Katie J. I live in Portland, Maine, and I'm excited to talk about insulin today.
Awesome. And Megan?
Hi, I am Megan Morrison. I am in San Antonio, Texas, and I've been on the podcast a few times now, and I love doing this. So happy to be back and happy to be talking about insulin resistance because it is so prevalent, really, like worldwide.
Yes, yes. And I think sneaky too, like even in people that are like underweight or not overweight, there this kind of stuff sneaks up on us too, which we'll talk about. So just to intro the topic a little bit, we're going to be talking about insulin resistance as it pertains to pre-diabetes and also diabetes and even maybe some not ideal space in between there. And really the reason we're talking about this and the reason I think a lot of us are passionate about this is because almost 50% of adults in America have pre-diabetes or diabetes, which is insane to think about. But at the same time, you know, I go to the grocery store or you're traveling and you're just looking around, and along with this, like the rates of obesity are really just skyrocketing. And we really just have to take this ownership back as to how can we actually fuel our body with good things. And there's a lot of pieces to the obesity epidemic, and we've talked about some of those before. There's genetics, there's the food supply issues, there's poverty, there's, you know, lots of different factors that go on, and stress and psychological things. And so we aren't going to go into all of those different pieces today, but particularly today, we're going to hone in on insulin resistance and what that means for us and what you can do about it to try to help your body to optimize your blood sugar control. There has been predicted by the International Diabetes Federation that there are going to be 592 million cases, with an additional 175 million cases by 2035, which is crazy. I mean, 2035 sounds like it's like light years away, but I know it's not. I don't know about you guys. You think like the 90s were like yesterday, right? That's what I feel like.
Oh, yeah.
It feels like in my brain. I'm like, oh yeah, well, I guess it was like 12 then, right? Okay. So insulin resistance. So why don't one of you guys just break it down for us? Like, what is insulin resistance? What happens, and why should we care about this?
I'm going to try to break this down in a term. I try to think of it in terms that I understand. So hopefully, you know, this will make sense to everyone, but let's think of when we eat, and mainly when we're talking about carbohydrates. So when we eat carbohydrates, the body breaks them down into sugar, right? Or glucose. And the glucose needs to be shuttled around through the body to be used for energy. And insulin, I like to think of it as a key. So the glucose gets to your cells and it needs to be let in to do its job, mainly to be used for energy, right? Well, insulin is like that key that binds to the receptor, kind of opens or unlocks the door, and then glucose or sugar is let in and does its job. So when we're insulin resistant, think about putting that key into the lock or the keyhole, and you're trying to turn it and it's not turning. Like, it's not unlocking, the door's not opening, the sugar is not getting into the cell. That is like insulin resistance. And it creates this thing, this hyperinsulinemia state, or high insulin state in the body. And that is not good. Our body loves to be in homeostasis or balance. So when we have too much insulin, that's not a good thing. If we have too much blood sugar because it can't get into the cells to do its job, that's not a good thing. So this insulin is trying to unlock the door. It's not working. It's not unlocking. And the body thinks, oh my gosh, I need to release more insulin because I need this blood sugar. I need the sugar out of the blood into the cell. So again, we have all of this insulin in the body, and we'll talk about why that is not a good thing.
Yeah. And I like to think of it, like, I always tell my patients, it's like an old rusty barn door. You know, you're trying to like jam this key in and it's like not going if you need more of a visual, right. But yeah, that door's just not swinging open. And when we fix the insulin resistance, I sort of like to imagine that we're like spraying like WD-40 on that rusty lock. And then all of a sudden the door opens and we're good. But the WD-40 can look like a lot of different things. There's lots of different tools in our toolkit, which we're going to talk about too. So awesome. The hard part about this is that we don't feel any different. I have patients tell me even when their blood sugars are 300 and 400, I don't feel any different. What is this like actually doing to me? So let's talk a little bit about what are the problems. I don't know if Katie wants to take that one. Like what is the problem when my insulin is high and my glucose is high? Like what's going to happen to me?
Yeah. So you definitely don't want glucose and sugar to be hanging out in the bloodstream. So you think about the complications of diabetes, of having nerve damage and that kind of thing. That's from the sugar crystallizing and sitting in those sensitive areas in your nerve cells. And, you know, insulin, it's an essential hormone in our body, and every organ uses it, especially your brain and your liver, the muscle tissues, those blood vessels, and also fat tissue, our adipose tissue. But it's also our primary hormone for storing fat. And so when we have all this insulin floating around, because the body's trying to move the glucose, then you get more storage of fat, especially around your middle area, your belly fat. And this kind of fat called visceral fat is particularly dangerous because it sits on the vital organs and puts pressure on the vital organs. And also that area, the visceral fat, is releasing its own hormones. And then that causes a whole cascade of inflammation and other abnormalities. So it's not just about sugar. It's also about that extra fat storage. And then also it acts on your brain, increase your appetite, or can change your cholesterol patterns, and so can lead to heart problems. So there's a whole bunch of things that cascade from having that hyperinsulinemia all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, like the cardiovascular piece of this is like really one of the most important parts to me, that like ASCVD is the most common form, which is this atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So if we think about things like angina or just like chest pain, heart attacks, peripheral vascular disease, stroke, all of those things are considered that atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. And this is all like what happens when we get this advanced glycosylation or this sugar that's causing damage in the cells. And it can happen years before even someone is diagnosed with diabetes. It can be happening, some of this increased risk can happen in the previous years. So for patients with diabetes, it actually occurs almost 15 years earlier and with greater severity than patients without diabetes. And so some of those things are some of the leading causes of death and disability. So we think about strokes and how dangerous they can be for people and how much they can be life-changing. I had a patient, I was overseeing one of my other pharmacists, and she had a patient that was in a wheelchair, like used to be a bus driver, but now husband has to care for her in a wheelchair all the time because of her post-stroke complications. So that's what I really like to talk to patients about, is that we're working to prevent those really dangerous things. It's not just about this number being perfect. It's about how do we optimize our physiology, like you guys are talking about, to actually prevent having some of the severe complications of diabetes. So the high insulin you mentioned, Katie, causes like fat storage, which is sort of a vicious cycle. You know, we're trying to help people lose weight and they've had this struggle to lose weight all their life. And it just compounds when the insulin increases, we get more fat storage and continues to cause more insulin resistance. So some of the other problems associated with high insulin can be that hormone dysregulation. I think we mentioned PCOS. So PCOS is the certain organ systems are more sensitive for insulin, and that, and the ovaries are a big one there. So there's a major connection between patients with PCOS and patients with diabetes or prediabetes or even gestational diabetes. And so all of those things are connected. Also patients that have estrogen dominance, and so some hormone imbalances too. And then people with diabetes are insulin resistance. There's insulin involved in the thyroid activation cascade. So a lot of people tend to have hypothyroidism. Sometimes it's diagnosed before the diabetes. Sometimes times the diabetes is diagnosed before that. Certainly it's not the most common cause of thyroid conditions. Hashimoto's, which we've talked a lot about before on the podcast, is, but it's definitely a connection there. And then some of the other things we've talked about before are the inflammation and then also even fatty liver disease. So fatty liver happens when we start to just deposit these excess fat and the excess adipose tissue in the liver. And then that whole process gets dysregulated, which we could talk more complex terms, but basically the insulin resistance combined with the inflammation combined with some of the gut health things are contributing to that increase in fatty liver. And it's crazy that we're even seeing fatty liver. One of the number one causes of fatty liver is actually fructose consumption. So you guys know what fructose is hanging out there. And unfortunately, despite this being a very well-known thing, we're selling it like hotcakes across the country in cans normally. And children are drinking this and children are having fatty liver at adolescent ages. And so we've got even people that aren't obese having fatty liver because of this high fructose in the diet in most Americans. So that's a big concern because fatty liver, not only, it's not just that your liver gets fat or fatty deposits, it's that that can eventually lead to cirrhosis and liver failure. And so again, there's always a reason why we don't want this physiology to be out of whack. So why don't somebody talk about how do I know if I have insulin resistance? So what markers am I looking at and where do I start?
Okay, I'll take this one. Ladies, jump in. But like I think Melody said, and maybe Katie, it's hard to really kind of capture this insulin resistance because we don't test for it. And it can be happening for decades before we actually get to that pre-diabetes or a diagnosis of diabetes. And so, you know, typically your doctor will run fasting glucose. That's on a typical lab panel, maybe sometimes even a hemoglobin A1C, and that gives you a kind of an average of your glucose levels over the past 3 months. But a lot of times we can have insulin resistance and our glucose is still normal. Our levels aren't out of whack yet because the body, you know, it is producing more insulin, but that insulin is getting the glucose into the cell. So one thing that we can do is super easy is a fasting insulin level. And that can tell you what your insulin levels are. Typically, you know, functional medicine, we like our ranges a little more tight and narrow. And so we'd want that to be less than 5 fasting or not to rise above 30 after 2 hours. Also, the fasting glucose can be helpful to look at. I'm not saying don't look at that, but again, functional medicine, we like our levels a little lower. So 70 to 90, and I've heard even lower, you know, maybe 70 to 80 or not above 85 is really ideal on that fasting glucose. But also if you don't get a lot of physical activity, if you do have a lot of that visceral fat that Dr. Katie was talking about earlier, I mean, those are kind of signs that you may have a little bit of insulin resistance going on. So trying to lose weight and just be more physically active. And obviously, we're going to talk a lot about what we do to prevent or reverse insulin resistance in a little bit. But those are just some of the things that we think of, oh, there probably is some insulin resistance going on.
Yeah. There's an article in the American Journal of Medicine in 2008 that talked about the pre-diabetes. So people that had in glucose levels of 100 to 125, that those microtubule damage, so that's, you know, in the kidney, actually started when those patients had the glucose of 90. And again, why in optimal physiology and optimal health, we want that to be lower. And then there was also some data that said every point above 85 is a 6% increased risk for diabetes. So again, as you're getting closer to the 90 and the 100 mark, we have more likelihood that you'll have diabetes in your lifetime. So certainly there's a lot of reasons for fluctuations in blood sugar, and maybe it's not going to be exactly that every day, especially if you had Thanksgiving dinner the day before or something. But in general, if your body is responding to insulin, it's producing the right amount of insulin, we should be able to keep those blood sugars under 90 in a healthy state. But we're going to, again, talk about reasons that we might that might cause those to be elevated and where we start sort of in this functional medicine picture with insulin resistance. Other markers that might be signs of insulin resistance are the elevated triglycerides and also some liver enzymes. So sometimes the liver enzymes, especially in people that may have that fatty liver component as well, we might see in that on your lab test, it will read like AST or ALT. And then also if you have an increased waist circumference, that can be a sign. Even skin tags can be a sign of insulin resistance. Another sign that you can often see is a darkening around the neck, and it's called acanthosis nigricans. So if you start to see some signs like that, especially combined with the skin tags, and if you're overweight or have some of these other lab markers, it's definitely something to consider as far as insulin resistance goes. So certainly there's a lot of people like, oh, my grandma had skin tags, my mom has skin tags. Well, it's probably because there's some hereditary components of this insulin resistance picture too. So you definitely want to be evaluated and get those tests that Megan mentioned, the fasting insulin, and maybe even a postprandial insulin, because oftentimes the postprandial response or that after meal response is really what we lose first. Sometimes the fasting levels can be completely fine, and then that after meal blood sugar or the after meal insulin level might be sort of off the charts. So those are things, and a reason we're going to talk about CGM as a tool to monitor your blood sugars in this particular stage. So the gut diabetes connection. So this is what we're going to move on to talk about this. So there is probably, I don't know, articles like daily coming out about how the gut is connected to metabolic syndrome, how the gut is connected to other conditions. And so we talk about the gut and the functional medicine a lot. We talk about it a lot on this podcast, but there's certainly data that shows that alterations in our microbiome, the less diverse our microbiome is, the more issues we have with our metabolic system. And so, Katie, do you want to talk a little bit about the different pieces of the gut microbiome and how that plays a role in insulin resistance?
Yeah, sure. The gut isn't just alone, isolated on its own. You know, it interacts with us and can be definitely influencing insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. And the main mechanism we can think of is that low-grade chronic kind of inflammation that's going to change the way that we metabolize and use energy and use glucose. So one of the things that it's a long word, it's called lipopolysaccharide, or LPS for short. And this comes from the membrane of bacterial cells. And this has been, you know, shown to kind of activate that like inflammatory pathway and set off inflammation in the body, which is also linked to insulin resistance. Also, I love these guys, short chain fatty acids, or SCFAs. Yes.
Which oh, I've never heard them called SCFAs.
SCFAs.
Do people say that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, that's the cool. That's the cool word.
The cool way to say it. SCFAs. All right.
SCFAs. Yeah, because short chain fatty acids isn't as exciting. Right. So those are the byproducts that we get to benefit from that our good gut bugs produce when we eat produce and fiber. And so butyrate is a big one. That's the main kind of source of energy for your gut wall. And so it helps have a protective effect, and it definitely helps with insulin sensitivity. So there's been studies showing that the bacteria involved in producing SCFAs are a lot lower in people with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Yeah. And with that LPS piece, and this is like a common component of the gram negative bacteria. And a lot of those gram negative bacteria we find when we do stool testing, or patients are having a lot of like bloating symptoms. I mean, I can't tell you the person, I mean, it's probably like 90% of my patients with diabetes have some kind of bowel issue, whether it's constipation, diarrhea, bloating, gas. I mean, sometimes the men don't have complaints, but almost 100% of women that have diabetes have some kind of gut thing, which I think really tells you, you know, the connection we have here between the gut. And a lot of times it is these bacteria that are imbalanced, and we get these inflammatory signaling molecules like Katie mentioned.
Yeah. And then that brings us to the leaky gut, which, you know, everything comes back, I feel like, to leaky gut, you know, when things are getting through that aren't supposed to, like these LPS molecules, and causing some endotoxemia,
right?
A fancy word for toxins in your blood, which you don't want.
Yeah.
I get, you know, and all this inflammation and just chronically going on day to day, years and years, you know, till you get the diagnosis of diabetes, probably preceding that 10, 20 years in advance, are things that are already, you know, body is not in homeostasis for that amount of time.
Yeah. And what about bile acids? How does that play a role?
Yeah. So those are made in the liver. And then, you know, primary bile acids. And then they get recirculated or reused from the gut. So some of the bacteria in the gut are able to deconjugate those primary bile acids to keep them from going back to the liver. And so then this helps metabolize them more into secondary bile acids. And these help with energy. So you're moving the glucose into the muscles, which is where you want it to be used. It helps with insulin sensitivity. It's a big one.
Yeah. And there's also the role of bile acids also plays a role in signaling. So it's interesting, like when I start talking about this to professionals in the endocrinology world, there's so much of the short chain fatty acids and also the bile acids that play a role in signaling are GLP-1 and other what's called incretin hormones that help to tell the pancreas to make insulin. And so when we lack the bile acids or we don't have the proper bile flow, this all gets disrupted. And so you think about patients that have had their gallbladder removed, there's definitely a correlation. Now, causation, we don't really know chicken before the egg scenario. If it's removing the gallbladder is the cause of metabolic syndrome or diabetes, or is it just the inflammation in general that's causing both? So like, this is why you ended up with this inflammation in the gallbladder that caused you to have the gallbladder removed. But either way, there's a lot of connection between the two conditions, especially I meet a lot of women in my office with diabetes that have their gallbladder removed that have these GI symptoms. And so bile acids can be really important to that signaling process as well. And also if they're not going back to the liver, then that means that we have the ability for the liver to make new. And then it uses up some of those stored triglycerides and things to make that so we don't get those elevated triglycerides if we have the perfect process happening. So, all right. And then other things. So as far as like why someone should care about like this whole process and not just, you know, hey, come to the office, let me give you a medication. And so certainly there are lots of medications, several good medications on the market that may be needed. And we're never saying like, don't use a diabetes medication to lower your blood sugar, because the earlier we lower your blood sugar, the less likely you're going to have those complications. So with some of my patients, I say, let's just get your blood sugar under control. And then we will work together on all this optimization, functional medicine things to come off of it if that's your goal. And sometimes if we're talking to someone 20 or 30 years out from diagnosis, it might not be feasible at that point with the damage done to the pancreas and the damage done to some of the cells to completely reverse, but maybe we can use less by optimizing the lifestyle and maybe using some supplements and other things that we're going to talk about. So I don't want to necessarily say never use pharmaceutical medications. There's certainly pros and cons to a lot of different things. One of the most common medications someone might be prescribed is called metformin. And metformin works in a couple of different ways. It actually helps to sensitize the liver cells to, so I sort of, my WD-40 analogy, it's sort of like the WD-40, the liver cells, to tell it like, hold on, like respond to this insulin, and helps that insulin response there better, because the cells in the liver need to respond to that signal to stop sending glucose. When insulin binds to the liver, then that should be the signal like, we don't need glucose out anymore. So the liver's not then dumping glucose into the system. If the liver has this insulin resistance, just like the rest of the cells, and we don't have that good signal, the liver is going to continue to produce glucose despite the fact that someone ate and their glucose is already rising. So metformin can help in that process. It helps a little bit in the muscle cells with insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity. And then it also helps in the GI tract. So this is where some of the side effects come into play, is that metformin blocks the intestinal absorption of some glucose. So that means that then more glucose stays in your gut and doesn't get absorbed, which is in some sense is good. But with glucose, we have like this, if you think about your high school science and like passive diffusion, we've got water that then comes towards the glucose. So we get more loose stools. And some people that have this bacterial imbalance also, we might also get more fermentation, or the bacteria are eating this excess glucose in the gut, which can produce gas, bloating, diarrhea, all of those things. That's why some of our IBS patients that already have some of those symptoms struggle to take metformin, but even people that are fine baseline also may struggle to take metformin as well because of the GI side effects. But there's lots of people that can tolerate it fine. And there are some potential nutrient depletions with metformin. So B12 vitamins can be depleted, other vitamins in the B vitamin family. And we want to make sure, so we do check those. We check our CBC once a year for patients that are on this medication, which is a blood count. But it'd probably be worthy to just check a B12 itself and make sure that that's okay. Or you can preemptively supplement with a B complex or something. If you don't use your B vitamins, your body gets rid of them and they're not stored. And then the other things with metformin, that there actually is a positive effect on the gut microbiome in some ways. So the fact that Acromantia species, which is a good bacteria, can actually increase metformin can actually cause increases in that. We see correlation that more Acromantia means less risk of diabetes. So it is helping a little bit, and there's lots of complexities that we could go to in that, but it is often a go-to because it's cheap and it is effective as far as lowering blood sugars, but tolerability sometimes can be an issue. But then the other medications that are sort of next line therapy, when we look at the American Diabetes Association guidelines and also the guidelines from the American Endocrinologist Association, are these GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitors. So GLP-1 is interesting because it is a natural hormone in our body. When we eat food, we start chewing, our stomach starts to create some of this GLP-1, and then that message, that signaling molecule, goes and tells the pancreas to make insulin in a glucose-dependent manner. So depending on how high your glucose is, the GLP-1 will signal the pancreas to make the insulin. But there's a few other hormones that are similar that are involved in that process. And then there's also this effect where when we should feel that sense of fullness, that we have this, you know, satiety is what it's called. So we feel full because GLP-1 signaled even the brain to say, hey, you're full, you don't need to eat anymore. And then with that, GLP-1 also helps to stop the signal to the liver to produce the extra sugar. So there's a lot of things going on in that. And it even slows down the stomach from emptying into the small intestine as rapidly, which is a sort of thing that's broken in diabetes, where we see more of a rapid emptying and spike of blood sugars after meals. With that, GLP-1 is really targeting like a lot of different places in that piece of the puzzle that's broken. So I like to say it's probably one of the most functional options that we have. And there are GLP-1 medications that have data for cardiovascular risk reduction, which is really important. So there's even discussion in the European Association of Study of Diabetes groups that should we be doing these first? Should we be doing this before metformin? The cost piece is the hard piece to juggle there, because it definitely is going to cost the healthcare system a lot more. But if we have these other positive benefits like the cardiovascular risk reduction and other things, like maybe that should be our first line therapy. It's not now. It's not approved to be first line therapy right now, unless someone doesn't tolerate metformin or can't take metformin for some reason. But it's something, you know, that's going to be a continual conversation, because it does address more of what we call the pathophysiological deficits, or those pieces of the puzzle that are broken in diabetes. And then the last one I'll mention, the SGLT2 inhibitor, is interesting because people without diabetes, we don't spill glucose into our urine until our blood sugar gets above like 200. But people with diabetes, they actually don't spill it until a higher amount, maybe 220, 240. And the reason for that is our body is trying to help the situation when we've got so much glucose coming through the kidney to be filtered. And the body's job is actually normally to reabsorb glucose. So, you know, when you're eating and you're going out on a long walk and then you're not going to eat for several hours later, your body is going to filter your blood in the kidney, and then that glucose should be reabsorbed. But in the situation where there's a lot of glucose coming through the kidney, what do you think the kidney does? It reabsorbs more. So it actually like has this response where, hey, I've got so much glucose going, I'm going to upregulate the receptors and I'm going to reabsorb more. So that means it's going to be a longer period of time before they start to see that they're urinating out glucose. So what this medication class does is actually blocks the receptor in the kidney that causes reabsorption of glucose, so that someone then urinates the glucose out. There's cardiovascular risk with this. There's implications in patients with heart failure. So there may be reasons to use this, again, depending on where somebody's at on the spectrum of diabetes and what their other comorbidities are and things like that. So definitely a conversation to talk. They've got some good, you know, cardiovascular risk reduction and stroke reduction data. And they're using them because they're glucose dependent. So it's only sending glucose into the urine when your glucose is high. Again, it's going to have a little bit anywhere over, anytime your blood sugar is over 70, which is most of the time, but it's going to increase the load of glucose that exits the body in the urine as the glucose rises. But even patients can tolerate that don't have diabetes. So this is class of medications being used for heart failure in patients without diabetes. So it's pretty cool, some of the advances they have, but those are sort of like the main three that are the most commonly and should be the most commonly used. There's definitely some other medications that we probably don't have time to talk all about today, but sulfonylureas is one that you would want to avoid. If this is like type 2 patients, type 1 patients, we're going to be on insulin, unfortunately, because that's the pancreas is no longer making insulin because of the autoimmune destruction. But with type 2, one of the other cheaper medications is called a sulfonylurea. And the challenge with sulfonylureas is that there's a lot of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar with that because it's telling the pancreas, make insulin, make insulin, make insulin. And it doesn't care how what your blood sugar is at the time. And so 40% of patients with those medications actually have low blood sugar. So honestly, even like a low dose basal insulin is safer from that perspective than those medications. So we try to steer clear of those. I can count on probably both my hands the times I've prescribed one of those medications. And I'm normally pulling them off of people if I can and trying to use some of these safer agents again that have the cardiovascular risk reduction. All right, that's enough about the meds. And we will talk about some of the lifestyle things. So who wants to talk about the diabetes prevention program?
I'll mention that. Okay. I thought it was really cool and a great way to start kind of our talk shifting to what do we do in functional medicine to prevent or reverse insulin resistance. So there was a study done in 2002, which is now 20 years ago.
Like, how is that possible?
Yeah, I know. So 2002, the study looked at 3,234 people with prediabetes, and they were randomized. They received either metformin, which Melody just talked about, lifestyle modification, or placebo. And they had this goal of, a couple of goals. They had a weight loss goal of 7% of their initial body weight. And then they needed to maintain that weight loss throughout the trial. And the trial was, I think, 2.8 years. So the weight loss goal of 7% of initial body weight, and then the physical activity goal was at least 150 minutes per week of moderate physical activity. So that would be similar to, say, intense, like brisk walking. And so at the end of the trial, and they compared the metformin and the lifestyle modification to placebo, the lifestyle intervention reduced the incidence of type 2 diabetes by 58%, while metformin decreased the incidence by 31%. And that was statistically significant. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Tongue-tied. Yeah, I know. But I mean, how cool is that? Like, this was 20 years ago now, showing that lifestyle intervention has these amazing effects on reducing incidence of type 2 diabetes. And, you know, it's actually in the guidelines, lifestyle intervention is our first, our go-to, but, you know, and we can, that's a whole other discussion, but how many times was your doctor a lot, you know, talking about all this stuff? It's normally just put someone on medication, and obviously depending on how advanced things are determines when you want to start medication. But the cool thing, I think, I don't know if cool is the right word, but you know, insulin resistance, there's so much we can do to prevent and reverse it. So it's sure. Like, this isn't all gloom and doom, like so much we can do. And we'll get into that now.
Yeah. And I think the difference between what this study did and also what we're recommending as functional medicine providers, like I would love to see, and maybe we're going to have this data someday when we implement our diabetes prevention program, but the data of like how much better this could be if we actually use a diet that is like a Mediterranean diet and good, colorful fruits and vegetables and lots of fiber, and looking at all of the picture of everything with functional medicine, with stress and with sleep and all these different things, because they really just focus very much on weight loss is what I need to achieve, and let me decrease my calories, or let me decrease this and let me exercise. But there weren't any of these other conversations. And so I think the results would be, I mean, I'm biased, but I think the results would be a lot better if we looked at the whole picture too. And so that's what we're going to move forward to talk about now. So when we talk about diet, we already did a podcast a couple times ago that we recorded about what is this diet versus that diet and where should I include these things. But first of all, we have to have a good microbiome. And so people that are out there, the keto diet can be helpful for people. especially when they need to lose a lot of weight. But we have to do it in a way that is sustainable. And it's probably going to be a little more like a low carb Mediterranean diet, because we have to have that fiber. If we don't have that fiber and our microbiome diversity decreases, like, we're worsening the situation here, with, like we talked about, with the gut and the role of a lot of the pieces of the gut bacteria. So we need fiber. So eating the rainbow is something we talk about a lot. Eating colorful things, low glycemic, which means those things that aren't going to spike our blood sugar as quickly. So lots of berries and dark fruits and vegetables, eating those cabbage that's purple and the carrots that are purple, you know, to get that color and to have some different things. I always laugh because my grandma, the last couple of years of her life, she's like, I've never seen a purple carrot in my life, you know? And so I'm like, I promise they existed. I mean, they just started selling them at the grocery store, I guess, mainstream, maybe in the last 10 years. So, but there's lots of different foods that we can get those colors from. And then finding that good ratio. And this is where working with a clinical nutritionist or dietitian is going to be really important for you, because you are an individual. We say that all the time. And your metabolism, your life circumstances, your day-to-day is different than the next person. So to take this, everybody needs this amount of carbs, or everybody needs this diet, it's not going to work for you. So finding a nutritionist that can, or a registered dietitian that can work with you and determine what that looks like for your meals is going to be really important. In general, we like to focus on those carbs that are from complex carbs, like our sweet potatoes and things that aren't going to spike as quickly, like our refined flours. And then making sure that when we do have carbs, we eat some protein first. That can be really helpful. And Katie, I liked your comment here. Do you want to say that?
Yeah, no naked carbs. Dress them up. Dress them up with some protein and fat.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And again, there's some studies that if you ate your protein first and then the carbs, it actually reduces the spike in glucose, because your body's already started got that insulin running and going. So, and that process. And then the glycemic thing. So soda, I mean, I tell my patients all the time, if you can do one intervention, the easiest thing to do is stop drinking the sugar. You can drink other things. Yes. Yes. The soda has to go. And ultimately, like, I'm going to just have to add more and more medications to someone if they refuse to get rid of the soda. I mean, I've had people 7 cans of Mountain Dew a day, or they're drinking 2 liters of Mountain Dew a day. It's like, we can't do this. I don't even know how you like don't pee like all day long if your blood sugars are this high and you're drinking this much caffeine. But it's gotta be, that has to be a choice. And sometimes I can't change people's choices, especially in the family medicine realm. You have to say, I'm going to do this for my health and find another option. And unfortunately, diet soda is probably not the best other option, because the chemicals substitutes in the sugar, or the sugar substitute in there, often also contributes to insulin resistance. So it's not causing a spike right then, but it's contributing to insulin resistance later. You can find something sweetened with stevia, monk fruit, and some other things that is probably a little safer. The stevia, I would limit still. I wouldn't be stevia in it all day long, because it is more processed than just finding a stevia plant and blending that in with your lemonade. But it is plant-based. And then fats, we talk about a lot. The fats really high quality. The Mediterranean diet is full of extra virgin olive oil, you know, trying to do more of those monounsaturated fats. Some saturated fats are okay. We don't want to go crazy with that. And doing some studies on, or testing on your own genetics and how you handle saturated fat could help you decide. So again, working with someone that can do the nutrigenomics testing. And then hydration is important. Fiber is so important. Again, we can't talk about fiber enough. Sometimes people even need fiber supplementation because they're not getting the 15 to 20 grams of fiber a day that they should be getting. And then movement. I mean, movement is such a key component. So many of the patients that I take care of, it's like trying to get them even, they're like, well, I walk my dog, or I go for a walk down the street and come back. But honestly, that's not getting their heart rate up enough. And there's so much important pieces about muscles and how we train the muscles and resistance training that needs to be a piece of this, and not just the casual cardio. So one of the challenges, people often have injuries, especially as we age. So there may be reasons why people can't do certain types of cardio, but asking for physical therapy can be something that can be covered on your insurance, to see like what exercises can I do? How can I build these large muscle groups in my body? How can I prevent further back injury by building up different parts of my muscle structure? So working with physical therapist is really a key component, or a personal trainer if that's something that someone can afford. And then, all right, someone else talk about sleep.
Melody, could I mention something about movement real quick?
Yeah.
One thing that is really neat is just walking after you eat a meal can help with that glucose spike.
Right.
So your glucose won't spike as much and it can just help a lot. So sometimes just think about maybe depending on where you work, you might not be able to get out and walk after lunch, but even after dinner, go for a 20-minute walk. Use that time to just kind of like decompress, be outside in nature, but that can really help with your glucose levels.
Yes, so, for sure.
I just love walking and there's so many benefits to it. You know, I think a lot of times we say cardio and I think a lot of us think of like this high intensity stuff, running or doing things that we may not love and like walk, dancing, gardening, like all those things can be beneficial.
Yeah.
The main goal is to just move our bodies.
Yeah. And even yoga has data for reducing blood sugars and insulin resistance. So finding a yoga instructor that is familiar with that and can really calm down that stress response, which we haven't talked about a lot yet, but we talk about stress all the time. And the cortisol spikes also increase our blood sugar and can often be a common cause of why fasting blood sugar can be elevated in someone that's insulin resistance is not so bad is because of the cortisol rise overnight and having this excess cortisol production, this dysregulation in their hormones. And that really goes into the sleep component too. But even just a few nights of impaired sleep can contribute to insulin resistance. So we really have to make a conscious effort to try to get that 7 to 8 hours of sleep, 7 to 9 hours of sleep, depending on who you are. I'm one of those people that really needs more sleep than the average person. I still feel a little tired at seven. So making sure you feel out what your body needs and finding that consistent amount of sleep is going to be really important. But there's associations with sleep duration to obesity, there's associations to cardiovascular disease. And again, the stress levels and figuring out meditation, yoga, what works for you. Maybe you have to do some testing and get your hormones in balance. And maybe that requires working with a provider and making some specific supplement recommendations to help with the stress. But all of those things are connected. So we are going to finish this with some of our nutraceutical favorites. And I will say before we get to that, like when you meet a functional medicine provider and if that's not someone on our team or someone else, like when we're talking to someone with diabetes, we are not just saying, oh, your blood sugar is this, here's what you should take. It's not going to be that conversation like it would be in a traditional medical model. Guidelines still recommend that diet and exercise are the first line therapy. And I will say there's a lot of great providers out there telling their patients to do diet and exercise. It's just that most primary care providers don't have time to spend and figure out what diet's going to work for you, what exercise is going to work for you. And they've got a 15-minute period, and that's the time they have to talk to you about everything that they are supposed to talk to you about. And so it can just be really challenging in that encounter to get the information out to them that you need to tell them for them to make back that recommendation. So that's really why a part of our intake process in functional medicine, it's long, it's extensive. We ask a lot of questions, but we're learning about you. We're going to ask more questions when we need to. And that's really the starting point. So we address and identify if there's that gut dysfunction, like upfront, talk about that and how this all connects. We're going to talk about your sleep. We're going to ask you to figure out how to sleep more. No, I'm not going to say, okay, well, you can just take a supplement to help reduce insulin resistance because you're only sleeping 4 hours a night. No, we have to address and fix that and help your circadian rhythm. And then we also have to address the stress component. We also didn't talk a lot about this, but mitochondria are like the powerhouse of your cell. And oftentimes certain nutrient depletions can affect the function of that cell. And so that is also connected to this insulin resistance process. And so we're going to look, are you depleted in magnesium? Are you depleted in zinc? And see if there's places that we can help support CoQ10 that supports the mitochondrial function. So where can we support you? And then talk about that exercise. Are we doing the cardio? Are we doing the resistance training? And then even toxicity. So like mercury is connected to insulin resistance. We've got pesticides. Like, do we need to do some detoxification process to help support your body and getting rid of those if you have lab testing to support there, that they're there. We might even have you wear a CGM, which is a continuous glucose monitor, where you actually can watch your blood sugar throughout the day instead of having to check it on a meter all day long and see like, okay, this food spikes me. This combination of foods where I ate a salad first and then I had this potato, that doesn't spike me. Or like Megan said, I went for a walk after dinner. Wow, I didn't see that spike like I used to. So there's a lot of different pieces of this. And so after we do all of that, then is when we would say, okay, well, we're still maybe needing some additional support. What supplements might make sense? Or maybe there's supplements that make sense at the beginning if we're doing this all in combination, but it's not just, okay, here's a supplement. There's going to be work that's required on the patient and the person that's coming to us. So I just wanted to give that caveat before we move into the supplements, but someone take us through some of the supplements that we often recommend.
Sure. I'll take this one. So one of my favorites is the berberine. So berberine has been even put up against metformin and has been shown to be just as effective as that.
We have a blog post on that too, that we can link in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. So berberine's really good to help with glucose metabolism and improve the insulin sensitivity. Then other things like alpha lipoic acid or ALA, that's an antioxidant that mimics insulin and will increase the uptake into the cell of the glucose. Chromium is another one that's pretty popular. And this is a mineral that has been shown to be pretty low in patients with diabetes. And so supplementation is helpful for patients with that actually have the diagnosis of type 2, but also in to prevent and reduce the insulin resistance. Cinnamon. So cinnamon is, you know, a favorite in my cabinet. I use it excessively in my smoothies. So this has actually been shown to lower blood glucose and even help with some cholesterol markers. So, you know, this is an easy and delicious way to help lower your risk of developing diabetes. So yeah. Also vitamin D, you know, vitamin D is more like a hormone than a vitamin, but super important for whole body health. And low vitamin D is definitely associated with diabetes and obesity. And so supplementing with that has been shown to improve blood sugar control and insulin sensitivity. And again, you would want to work with your provider to see like if you are in fact low and what kind of dose you would need, because that would probably help with a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if there's one of the cinnamon types that is better or more well studied for the diabetes component, is it the cassia cinnamon or the Ceylon cinnamon? I think it's the cassia cinnamon. So yeah, most of the significant reductions in fasting glucose, several months of use. So if you're using it dietary, you can purchase like that. There aren't as many studies on the cinnamon supplements. So check that. But again, some of these supplements, some of these studies are people taking like 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams of cinnamon a day. So that may not be the same effect as just pouring it in your smoothie if you do have the insulin resistance. So it's certainly something, incorporate as much cinnamon you want into your diet, but you may have to get some of these study type responses. We may have to do more than that. But yes, and then the last one, the zinc component. So there are studies that show low zinc. Patients with prediabetes had lower levels of zinc levels. And they also, in those studies, gave zinc to a group of patients with prediabetes and then to a placebo trial. It was a placebo control trial. And the patients that took the zinc, and this was typically about 25 to 30 milligrams of zinc, depending on the study you look at, they had less progression to diabetes from prediabetes than the patients that didn't take zinc. And this is really interesting because zinc is involved in the production of insulin. It also reduced insulin resistance in the score. They use a HOMA-IR score. And so that's like a bunch of formulas that tell you your insulin resistance. So it reduced the insulin resistance too, and reduced CRP, which CRP is a measure of inflammation. So when we talk about how this is connected and the inflammation is connected and like zinc is involved, and I mean, just like magnesium involved in so many processes in our body, that we have to step back and look at the whole picture. And sometimes just supplementing with cinnamon, for example, is not fixing some of these nutrient depletions. So evaluating the nutrient depletion part is a really important part. And we didn't get into too much of omega-3 fatty acids, but the inflammation component there in omega-3s from the cardiovascular risk reduction standpoint can be really important too. So yeah, any final thoughts or words that you guys want to leave with our listeners about our almost hour-long conversation about diabetes? We could probably talk for more and more hours because there's just so much in this space that we can do, and we need people that are motivated to make these changes, and we're going to work with you, or another functional medicine provider is going to work with you, and we're going to, you know, walk through all these different steps and help you really get to where you need to be.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think the CGM piece is super interesting. Yeah. And again, we could probably do a whole podcast on that.
Right.
But just using that as like a personalized nutrition tool, because for me, example, like I ate a bagel once and I checked it and it didn't spike that much, but usually bagels, you know, you put that on the back list.
Yeah.
But then a banana, like bananas spike me up to over 150, like really quickly. So you don't, that's what you don't want is those super high spikes throughout the entire day.
Yeah.
You want more of like a slow rolling hill.
Right.
And so that's kind of cool to be able to personalize it to yourself. So if you do get a chance to, for non-diabetics.
Yeah. And we're working on a process with our patients that they can meet with one of our prescribers or do a secure messaging appointment to be able to get a CGM prescription as part of our program. So, but yeah, that's, they are prescription only. You can ask your primary care provider to write one. You can get that at the pharmacy and it is off label. I'll state that it's not, their labeled indication is for use with patients with diabetes. There's also, is it the one you've used, Katie, is through Nutrisense, right? Or
I've used a Freestyle.
And that's the one that that company uses too, which you can go on and purchase as well. We don't have any affiliation with them. So yeah, so definitely can be a tool. Dexcom is another tool, probably more expensive for someone that doesn't have a diagnosis of diabetes and insurance coverage for that type of device. The technology, that's why I love like still keeping a hand in like the traditional diabetes space in a way, because one, I can pull in all of this functional medicine stuff to those conversations, but the cool technology that goes along with it is really fun to learn about. And especially now that some of the pumps are communicating with these CGMs and adjusting their insulin rates based on that for a type one. So it's pretty cool. Well, I appreciate you guys and your time today to talk about insulin resistance. And again, if you guys are out there listening, you're like, oh my goodness, this is me. I need help. You can find us at farmtotable.life. It's PharmTotable.life. And click on find a provider and we will walk you through this process and individualize that to get you on the other side and your journey to thriving. So have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.